say, talk to me, talk to me, in your own.
In your own special way, that's right. Welcome New Mexico, around the country and around the world, if you're listening. Welcome to Dialogue, KSFR's Friday evening talk show, where the conversation starts with you. I'm your host, MK. If you're a regular listener, you know that I take on all sorts of topics and clearly pay special attention at times to the issue of mental health. Now, before you roll your eyes or sigh and say, not again, there's a reason I favor this issue. Its implications are far-reaching. It shares space with social issues that include everything from the over-medication of our children and elderly to domestic violence, crime, addiction, divorce rates, family stability, single parenthood, our social safety net, racial and economic disparity, education, our collective safety, gender issues, and even civil rights. At its root, it's about how we handle the unknown and our fear in encountering it. It affects how we see each other and define ourselves, individually and collectively. It is fundamental in defining how we view each other as human beings and, more importantly, how we interact. It literally affects how we talk to each other, from the personal to the professional to the political. Bottom line, it is an issue that affects everyone and can easily become a breeding ground for an us versus them mentality. And this can never be good. And no one knows that more than the family members who've had to deal with their loved ones having these labels placed upon them and the ramifications of all that entails, and the kind of stress that stigma can place on the family unit itself. It's now estimated that 1 out of 4 people experience some form of what we call today a mental disorder. And in the U.S., this number adds up to 450 million people a year, placing these disorders among the leading causes of ill health and disability worldwide. Oftentimes, when discussing this topic, we focus on the so-called illness itself, or quote, designated patient, unquote. But today we bring voice to what the families who are affected by this go through and why this can be so challenging. Because central to this issue is the dubious nature of exactly what it is and how we define it, what can lead many families into years of unanswered questions, misunderstandings, division, and turmoil, as well as even serious financial cost. Many families find themselves divided over the topic or in urgent situations with little help from the system, and others claim their lives have been saved by the system. We're going to get into the details of what some of the situations can look like for families and the many often painstaking dilemmas they find themselves in, often racked with guilt, shame, anxiety, isolation, and confusion, or being silenced or even vilified for asking questions or seeking alternative treatments. Joining me today is David Link from NAMI, Concha Garcia Allen, who is a licensed mental health counselor, as well as family therapists and open dialogue experts Kermit Cole and Louisa Putman. Louisa is on her way. She'll be joining us shortly, and I want to thank all of you for joining us today.
Thank you.
And one thing I do want to say, before you begin, if you can introduce yourself so then the listeners know who they're listening to, just say hi before you begin. You don't have to say it every time, but just to establish who you are in the conversation. But one of the reasons I also wanted to talk about this, and I think it's okay that we discuss this, but is the notion of lived experiences. So we're really coming at this today from a standpoint of not as much expertise in the field as much as the real lives of what families experience and go through and the kind of challenges that they can face. David, let me ask you, what you do in terms of working with families, because you yourself have been affected. And can you talk a little bit about your work with NAMI?
I can. NAMI is a national organization, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, and its work is primarily based on the experience of people who are living with mental illness, either within their family or within themselves. They tend not to be professionals. They're not psychiatrists, psychologists. There are some people who are in counseling who are involved in NAMI, but it's a more of a almost like a consumer's organization. So we have several programs. We have a 12-week course on the different aspects of living with mental illness. It's called Family to Family, and there's one ongoing right now that covers all the bases, from the social problems, the biology, or what's thought to be at least the biology of mental illness, and treatment options and local resources and all of that kind of stuff. Very comprehensive class. Then we also have family support groups, where we have trained facilitators who meet with family members who have that situation and who usually come with a great deal of trauma, upset, fear, uncertainty, doubt, just because of the impact of mental illness on a family. People come to us lost at sea, and they are people from all walks of society that just need to hear that they're not alone, that they're not doing this in isolation, that there are lots of other people who have been down this road for more time than they are. And they seem to find it very reassuring, even though a lot of what we do is just basic empathy and sharing what our experiences have been, ways that we've resolved things, ways that we've failed to resolve things, the whole gamut.
So, yeah, a place of support, basically.
It's a place of support. And then we also have similar things for people who have diagnoses. We have support groups for people who are all have a mental illness, and they support each other, whether they're medicated or not medicated or whatever their situation is. And then from time to time, we're actually able to generate a class on mental illness taught by someone who has one for people who have them. And those have been very strengthening for the patients who are in this situation. So that's the scope of our work. We do once a month public information meetings for the public at large as well, that also goes out on podcast from our website.
And if people want to find out more about you, where do they go?
NamiSantaFe.org.
NamiSantaFe.org. Okay. Now, I know for me, in terms of trying to cover this as a journalist, one of the things that I discovered, to my great surprise, was that there's still quite a bit of debate out there in the world and in the profession itself. I think that about even the term mental illness and the disease nature of it. And so I understand that is part of what's happening out there, correct? And Kermit, you're sort of in that world a bit. You can help translate some of that. But what I don't really want to get into heavily here is a debate over whether it is or it isn't, because you find that out there, the debate of what it actually is, but more so how that plays out as a form of tension within families, and there's just that this is a difficult thing to wrap one's head around just by oneself, much less for an entire family to wrap their heads around and deal with collectively. Can you tell us just a little bit about some of the issues in terms of the debate that exist regarding, quote, the use of the term mental illness?
Yeah, well, going back to what you noted in your introduction, that one in four people in the United States qualifies for, I think the phrase you used was mental illness. I think it begs the question when you're talking about one out of every four people, how much of that can really be thought of as illness, and how much of that can be thought of as this is part of just what is being human involves, that being human involves fear, distress, confusion, confronting new realities, new paradigms, changes, and learning how to do that together in a productive way.
If you just tuned in, we're focusing on the perspective of family members dealing with what we today call mental illness. We're also embracing new modalities of care, one of which includes what's called open dialogue, while also touching upon traditional perspectives on mental health.
And so in this context of this discussion, that brings us to what is the role of families in that. And And David was talking about empathy. I think that's the key thing, is how to, all the ways that we can learn how to maintain and cultivate and practice empathy, even in times when we're scared or where people are confusing or it's very painful to think of them as being connected to us. Because, I mean, I think that points to how much we depend on each other, to have clarity in order to feel that we have clarity. And once somebody has gone outside the bounds of what feels real or trustable or helpful to us, it's very hard to maintain empathy. There's a natural instinct to separate and try to fix. And in the work that Louisa and I have done over the years, we've learned that. And as they learned developing open dialogue, that when their focus shifted from trying to fix a person to creating spaces in which people felt safe to say what they need or say what they're trying to say or figure out how to say what they're trying to say, and creating spaces in which people can dialogue in productive ways, to their surprise, what they found in the people who've made open dialogue is that people got better, and now it's their standard, it's their automatic response to all mental health crisis calls. You know,
right.
911, somebody calls, and they gather the network, they gather the family, they gather whatever meaningful social network this is occurring in,
And that this is, I just want to be clear for the listeners who don't know or have never heard of open dialogue, kind of what it is a little bit more. So that's what you're defining, right? That's what you're describing is an open dialogue approach.
The people who are in charge of the system of the mental health care in Western Lapland and Northern Finland, they shifted their focus from trying to fix individuals to creating spaces of dialogue, and they found that their incidence of across the board of mental illness just went down, and especially notably schizophrenia was almost practical terms eliminated. That people who went into crisis that previously had lasted long enough to meet criteria to be diagnosed as schizophrenia didn't. Their crisis was resolved, and their five-year outcomes was that 84% of people were back in their lives,
which
is obviously a statistic that we can't really compare. So that if we find that to be a valid and important statistic to pay attention to, then I think it inevitably leads us to saying if there's a crisis that we're calling a mental health crisis, then our response, we should consider it to be exploring how a family can be helpful or how. I mean, my last statistic I'll throw out is that one of the statistics back in, I guess it was about 2002 that sent me down this road, was reading that people with adolescents with a bipolar disorder were 7 times more likely to recover if the family got family therapy. And so irrespective of, we don't even have to debate or even discuss what exactly bipolar illness is or if it's a disease or not, it's an interesting thing to talk about. But if the statistic is true that 7 times a child is 7 times more likely to recover if their family gets family therapy, it doesn't really matter what we're talking about. It just matters that 7 times more people get better.
Yeah, that's such a good point. And get so easily lost in this conversation because it's all about the debate. And it really is what you're saying is, no, it's about the solution. Whatever works for people in crisis, whatever we want to call it, and bringing the family in as the unit to help people walk them through that process. And I think, go ahead.
Well, just one thing. It's important that when you say what works, then we have to step back and say, how do we define what works? And
right.
So in so when people are in crisis, when they're scared, when they're, when there's a sense of urgency, certain things get defined as working, which sometimes can be, I'm not scared anymore because somebody is in a situation where they can't cause trouble.
Right.
I'm comparing that to the 84% statistic, 5-year outcome, that we have people who are working at school, having families and lives.
Yeah. Let's talk about that what works scenario too, though, because that can, I can any of you, and please feel free to chime in just as you feel like you want to chime in, feel free to do that. But
But let's talk about the kind of crises that families encounter with mental, when they're dealing with somebody in mental distress, extreme mental distress.
Well, when you talk about what works, a lot of times we're talking about the family. We're not talking about the person that's being affected by it. You know, when you're on the medication, you know, yeah, it works, you know, because the person is not causing you problems in the family. You know, they're basically numb, and that's easier to deal with than when they're in the psychosis and you don't know what to do and it's scary and you're going through your own problems of feeling guilty and shame, like you said at the beginning. You know, yeah, but it's like you look at the person and it's like, are they living a life? You know, are they and trying to have community around? I mean, you're really isolated a lot of the times when you're in your families, and it's hard to have community or family members around because they shun you, and or say put them in the hospital or you know, just separate yourself, and as a parent you can't do that. You can't shun your child. You can't put them in a, you know, in a hospital. And there's really not a lot of really support. I know David got support from NAMI. That wasn't a direction that I was able to feel comfortable in. And coming from a more Native perspective, I look at the communities, you know, in other countries where the child fits in, you know, he does or she does what they're capable of. If their parents are shoemakers, they'll learn a little bit of that,
no different than say a Down syndrome child.
Correct.
Right.
And in our country, I mean, it is such a stigma, and I think more than anything, that's the hardest thing to get over is. Once you're labeled with a mental illness, you yourself believe that you're never going to change. You're never going to get better. You're never going to be capable of doing anything. And boy, I mean, I couldn't live with something like that, you know, someone telling me that I'm not capable of doing anything. And then we don't have the support to even teach families how to try to understand where they're coming from. It's only our comfort level. What are we comfortable with? You know, we're comfortable with them numb, you know, as a parent, you're just totally broken because you know that person is capable of many things, but.
Yeah. Yeah, this is again where the diagnosis can be helpful to some, and some people feel greatly relieved and take the medicine or the drugs. And I've learned now to not say medicine because to some people they don't consider it medicine, but it is a drug, a psychoactive drug that helps, that can help some people in times of crises. And for some people that works and it helps them through that crisis or allows them to gain skills they might not otherwise have to focus or make it through that crisis. But for others, diagnoses and drugs actually do the exact opposite. They do
right.
not save their
right.
life. And I think that's important that we address both sides of the experience and don't stigmatize anybody who's ever in crises, right?
Right.
I mean,
right.
And say, listen, whatever works for you is great, but please don't put us all in one box. It is not one size fits all.
Yeah, the key there is creating a space for dialogue. And when you're judging, when you're afraid, when you're all that, then you can't talk. And so it's not just a matter of even just tolerating or accepting. It's a matter of fostering a space where a productive dialogue can take place. And what we've found, what Louisa and I, Louisa is here now, have found is that when you open up that space, even things that were previously alarming or frightening can not be.
Right.
You know, the fact that people believe things that I don't, you know, oftentimes I find myself saying to people, well, I probably believe a lot of things that aren't true, that, you know, I'm sure I believe a lot of things that aren't true.
Right, right.
I'm not in a position to judge. What matters is that we can work together.
It's a permission to say it's okay not to believe the mainstream interpretation of it as an illness or a disease. It's permission to say, I disagree, and that's okay. That doesn't make me crazy, or it doesn't make me dangerous to even think these thoughts, but rather to say, I just have a different perspective. It seems that open dialogue is a more open. And sometimes I've heard the challenge is that within our current model, open dialogue might be challenging to bring into our system, that we're not Finland, we don't have this tight-knit small community. But what you're telling me, Kermit, is I'm hearing, and also you as well, Concha, and you, David, is dialogue.
Yeah,
it can be done anywhere, doesn't cost anything, and respectful, empathetic dialogue that says, hey, everyone has a right to have their perspective.
It's really important to create that space. And I've worked with Kermit and Louisa, and just a few sessions with the family, you know, the ones that came, you know, like my older son, he didn't think his brother had any feelings anymore. But he was just really surprised when he heard his brother say, I feel guilty. And that completely shifted how his older brother saw his younger brother, you know, and to have them, have him be able to feel safe and say that, just to open up that place where he could get in touch with his feelings and have other family members see it and hear it was huge for me. I mean, that really shifted his older brother's whole sense of who his brother was. But he completely stayed away for so long. And that was really amazing, just that fact alone, that he was able to hear his brother say how he felt. And so I really encourage that, you know, like Kermit said, you know, dialogue, taking the time to listen to that person, you know. But again,
humanize them.
Yeah.
They're still a human being. Yeah, yeah. And somehow all these diagnoses can make people, and the fear and the strange behavior can make people dehumanize them somehow.
And to listen to all people, to make sure that everybody in the situation has an opportunity to speak.
Right.
Rather than have this focus on it being one person that's identified as the problem.
Right. Were you going to add more? Or did you? No. Yeah. Did you want to add anything, Louisa or David?
Well, I would like to throw open a little bit. We've been talking about the small arena, the person with the situation, the family members and community close around that person, the behaviors and feelings within the family. But we also have a larger social picture. We have a person who's, for whatever reason, is not able to support himself. So we have to go to the government for such things as disability payments to keep him going and medical treatment to address the situation. These entities, including the treatments, by and large are limited in scope to what's been propounded by the American Psychiatric Association, the, dare I say, the dreaded pharmacological industry, and financial concerns that are all built into all of their points of view. So they, as you and I have discussed, MK, is they have their dogs in the fight, and a lot of financial concerns that shape how they propose treatment. And I myself have to say it's pretty funny. You know, in 10 years I've gone through a lot of evolution too, from fear and loathing and grabbing for solutions that are produced, like, okay, my son is behaving this way. We give him the treatment as a drug treatment and a therapy, talk therapy to make him a one-to-one therapy, not group therapy, that such as you are talking about, Kermit, but just this one-on-one thing as an individual, treating him as an individual. That's a social thing, I think. You know, our society, America, is a society that's based on the fundamental faith in the individual as the primary actor in everything. That's why we have such massive loneliness. You know, we take drugs for loneliness.
That sometimes end up making it worse.
That sometimes end up making these situations worse, and so that's the model I was handed in desperation, and as I said, very much fear for the outcome of my family member. I latched onto it. And have and alternatives I just had no interest in. I just want to stay focused on that particular methodology. And but in time, I've learned to realize as I watched the methodology unfold and the different medications were tried, it seemed to me that at the end of the day, they were just throwing things up in the wall to see what would stick. And in some cases, some things stuck. Some things stuck with horrible side effects. Some things stuck and then fell off. And other things had to be tried. So there's no, it doesn't seem to be a really fixed in the medical world. There aren't these fixed solutions. And then because I began to see that, I began to think more about the social, personal, interactive side of things and learn to accept my son for who he is and what he is and try to find some, whatever I can find to connect with him personally and support him in his better side and not look at him with the stigma. I've had, in society, does stigmatize mental illness. In people, and I found it really hard to overcome the inner stigmatizing, even of my own son.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I'm still not over it. I still have to work at it every day. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah, I think that's a critical piece or component in it is that I think the whole family is suffering from this stigma. And it's just this people getting stuck in the unknown together and trying to find their way out, and it can cause a lot of fear. And I want to, but this brings us back, everything you said brings me back to this open dialogue concept again. I want to make sure and give listeners access to you all, just as I gave the NAMI information. Wouldn't it be wonderful if we could see NAMI and open dialogue find a way to come together to the table, just like we are right now? Is that what you're doing?
That's definitely, we're very much in conversation with NAMI increasingly, and it's very friendly and productive.
It's wonderful to hear.
Yeah,
we've been asked to speak at a meeting, but we just haven't figured out the logistics of it.
How do people get a hold of you?
You could email me at my name, Kermit Cole, KERMITCOLE at gmail.com. That'll reach us both.
If you just tuned in, we're focusing on the perspective of family members dealing with what we today call mental illness. We're also embracing new modalities of care, one of which includes what's called open dialogue, while also touching upon traditional perspectives on mental health. We need to take a break right now. We'll be right back after these short messages. You are listening to Dialogue. I'm MK. If you just tuned in, we're focusing on the perspective of family members dealing with what we today call mental illness. We're also embracing new modalities of care, one of which includes what's called open dialogue,
while also touching upon traditional perspectives on mental health. Joining me today is David Link from NAMI, Concha Garcia Allen, who is a licensed mental health counselor, as well as family therapists and open dialogue experts Kermit Cole and Louisa Putman, people who've had firsthand experience in dealing with a family member diagnosed with a so-called mental illness, one of the most challenging things for not just a single person to wrap their head around, but even more so an entire family. Concha, you mentioned this idea that a lot of dealing with a family member in crisis, it's really about our own fear of seeing somebody behaving in a way that feels abnormal or unpredictable or never seen before. I want to give voice to this experience, the most extreme situations when it comes to mental health crises and what those can look like. For instance, when somebody threatens violence to hurt somebody else or hurt themselves, and maybe even uses words like, I want to kill someone. That can be terrifying to deal with. And yet, in terms of psychosis, I have found out, as I've done my own research, that that is not as uncommon as one might think. And I don't mean to minimize that experience, but I've also learned that a fearful response can also sometimes even blow it out of proportion or potentially make it worse. Can anybody comment on that? How do we tell the difference between a crisis situation and perhaps one that our own fear might be making worse?
I can.
Yeah.
In our practice at NAMI, in our support groups, we always recommend that if a family member is at that level of distress and threatening harm to themselves or others, that it's acted upon. Taking no chances, because you never know when somebody's just going to suddenly do something. And we had a recent case of this here in Santa Fe, where a patient stabbed his counselor and then was shot by the police and killed. So the thing is to act and prevent before. That's a firm wall that we all have to have clear. We don't leave it to talking down, and we don't leave it to chance. And then once that's dealt with, then you can get back into why that's happening. But as a matter of security, it's absolutely necessary to act.
Is that the case in the realm of open dialogue?
Well, this is a really tricky, very difficult area, because I think, you know, we all want to believe that there's a sure and certain response at any given moment. And sometimes, of course, that can feel that way. Like if we dial 911, that feels like a sure and certain response. If a policeman or other, you know, uniformed or professional services arrive, then it feels like a sure and certain response. But it gets more complicated after that. Because, for instance, in the case of self-harm, in the case of suicide, actually the statistics are that somebody is 5 times more likely to commit suicide immediately after leaving a hospital. So there's an argument that putting somebody who's suicidal in the hospital is maybe not the best approach in all circumstances, that it didn't help. Right. And in those cases, at least 5 times more cases, it didn't help. Right. So in my experience working, when somebody says that they're thinking of harming themselves, my first response is to try to pick apart what exactly it is that they're expressing. Because I know I and many, if not most people, I think have moments of thinking of one way or another harming themselves. A lot of people have feelings of wanting to end it. A lot of people have or express feelings of wanting to kill somebody. And then once you start to pick it apart and look at it, it comes up different. And I'm not saying that there aren't times where people have to be, you know, forcibly dealt with, that is the right choice. It's the question, but there's a big gray area of, you know, nothing is sure and certain. And somewhere in all of this, we are all together having to join hands and figure out how to confront the uncertainty of the fact that we don't always know what a person means. We don't always know what we mean. And if we can create spaces in which that can be explored, many of the people who would be hospitalized or, you know, treated in draconian ways and wouldn't benefit from it aren't. And so it comes down to a society-wide balance, ultimately, of what, you know, when we talk about safety, you know, are we talking about the feeling of safety? Because in that case, we can make a law and we can do the exact same thing every single time. But I think when it, there's a lot of cases where, for instance, I mean, when it, I hope this isn't straying too much, but if we look at capital punishment, I think the reason it's a very popular penalty for a lot of people is because it gives them the feeling of a certain fix to a problem. When you look at the statistics, it is not. It is not. It, and in fact, there's a very strong argument. I have spent a considerable time studying, you know, people who are homicidally, who are in you know, psychiatric hospitals for gruesome murders. And there's a very strong argument that the reason that the, how they become this is by being dehumanized and not ever having been gotten the right kind of attention. And I know that sounds like bleeding heart liberal stuff, but it's just, you know, if you really look at it, it's just true. Treating people in those ways creates more killers, and having a society that treats people in that way does not diminish the number of killers. If anything, it creates more of them. So I think that that is transposable onto the question of how do we deal with any one person at any one moment who is feeling distress.
Did you want to add? There is a protocol, you know, when you have someone that repeatedly says they want to harm themselves or they want to harm someone else. I mean, and as a family member, you know, most of us that live with them know our relative, you know, our loved one. And there is a protocol when it's repeated and you see that they're in despair. But, you know, I find that most of the time if you ask somebody, it's like, you know, do you want to die or do you want to change, you know, things? And most of the time, your loved one is not happy with their life. And I mean, they're not, just because they're termed mentally ill doesn't mean they don't have feelings and they don't have a heart and they don't have things that they want to do. They want to change something in them. And we were talking about that word anger, you know. A lot of times I like to say, you know, you're fighting your fight, you know, instead of being angry and saying, you know, and being able to feel it and express it, you turn that back onto yourself, you know. You know, I had an instance with my son, you know, one day where he got really, really, really angry and he stood up and he's like, you know, a foot taller than me. And it was scary. But at the same time, it was like, I felt like, I am so glad you're letting your feelings out. You know, I know it's frustrating. I know you're having a hard time. I would love to see him be able to do that more instead of keeping it inside of himself and holding it back. I mean, it's frustrating. If I'm frustrated with him, I can't imagine how he's feeling. And we don't allow ourselves to go, okay, I am feeling this, and get help to see how he's feeling too. You know, that word anger, it's so vilified, you know. We're not allowed, we're told get over it, we're told stop feeling, we're told it's bad to get angry. It's like, no, that's a feeling. It's not bad or good. It's your feeling. And if we could get support, you know, and I have to admit, you know, when I have called the sheriff, because when I live out in the county, I have to admit they've been incredibly nurturing and caring with my son. That's not always the case with a lot of individuals. I feel like I've been fortunate, but I was happy that day that he was able to express his anger and even at me, and I held that space for him. We're not socialized, trained, you know, for this person to go, I am so frustrated, I want to kill myself, and have that safe space for them. Immediately we get scared and we put them away. That's the answer, like, you know, Kermit was saying. It's like there's one pat answer to make us feel safe. Well, what about this person, you know?
Right. Yeah, it's interesting because I just interviewed Dr. Chuck Ruby from the International Society for Ethical Psychology and Psychiatry, and he was talking about how, you know, that persecution is one of the characteristics that some of the mass shooters have, and that actually forcibly putting them away makes them feel more persecuted, more stigmatized. Yeah. And it certainly, that's why it also begs the question for the need for more open dialogue again, better alternatives before we get to the crisis point or the flash point of that level of anger. If we can intervene and allow, as you're saying, these moments of anger to come up and give them a place to go, a safe place to go, perhaps that's the beginning at least of a solution.
Yeah. There is a clear protocol, you know, when you know your loved one and they're in that place of they want to kill themselves, you know, and you act on that. I mean, if I can say, I worked at the Sky Center, you know, which is the suicide prevention here in Santa Fe, and there is a clear protocol that you don't hedge on, you know, if you know that your loved one is in danger of suicide, you know. But in a lot of cases, like I said earlier, you ask him, you know, do you want to die or do you want to change? And for the most part, if a little change happens, it changes the picture for them.
Right. I think the real danger in the, you know, when somebody says, I want to die, and that becomes the avenue of exploration, do you, and I'm agreeing with you, I'm not disagreeing, that, I mean, so many people that I've talked to, they say, you know, I feel like I want to commit suicide, but I don't want to be dead. And so that means that I'm crazy, because that doesn't make sense. And then when I say, you know, so many people say that to me, I hear that all the time. Then they say, really? Wow. Yeah, because maybe when you're saying, let's look at that. When you say you want to die, maybe, as Katya's saying, you know, I need a change. I need a break. I need some rest. There's a part of me I can't stand anymore. I want to change.
Yeah.
So if you open but if you get focused on, okay, you know, I mean, I'm not against the protocols, of course. And I want to say again also that the emergency services here are very thoughtful and very excellent, you know, compared to many or most. And the MIHO program is very good. And so I do have faith in our services here. But, you know, but just to be armed with the idea of when somebody says a thing, it doesn't necessarily mean exactly that. And opening up a space where you can say, what is it that this means?
Sometimes, you know, I want to strangle somebody.
Usually it's born somehow from not feeling heard or an extreme sense of powerlessness, you know, or invisibility. It's like, do you want to kill this person or do you want them out of your life? Maybe you've just had enough with what they're doing right now for the moment.
Right.
Or, so sort of metaphorical language, but it's easy to get lost in that and panic sometimes ourselves. And yet then there is, and this is the challenge for families, is to say, okay, wait a minute, this is a moment I have to pay attention to. How do I decipher between the moment that is just an expression of anger and one that might be a real danger? I just want to note that because families have to deal with these kinds of crises. And there are times you love the system and thank you, God, you're there.
Right.
You saved my son's life by taking him away or my father's or whoever it is. And at the same time, then there's other times where they get put away and you walk away feeling like you've just betrayed this person.
Oh, my God.
You know, like in the most fundamental way.
It's horrible.
Right.
It's horrible when you leave your child. Mm-hmm. It's horrible. You know, you feel like you're betraying them. You're guilty, you know. But you don't have a lot of alternatives.
Right, right. I think that's so important. This idea of the betrayal and how hard that is.
I'd like to speak to that a little bit.
Yeah.
Families who are going through the crisis of the first outbreak are themselves in crisis.
Right.
Their judgment is not all that great. Mm. They don't understand their loved one's behavior. They don't understand what it means. So it is absolutely necessary to put up a fence to protect the person and everyone else. And then, and sometimes, as Concha mentioned, you call 911, and we are fortunate here. We have crisis intervention trained officers that usually respond. And in addition, they will often bring professional crisis people with them. So they get through it pretty well, and very often that's all you need to do. And they're able to determine how serious this is. But in that moment, they can't get to Kermit. They can't get to Concha for an open dialogue and an exploration of what's really going on internally. You just have to have this fence. And then when it's time to open a door in the fence, you open a door in the fence and go through and make these things happen. And that's also true of institutionalizing. Sometimes people really need to step out of their environment and be treated by professionals and explored with explored by professionals. And I'd say we've, on the whole, in our family, we've had good success with that. However upsetting it is for us to confront that, the outcome has been better than if it hadn't happened at all.
Yeah. One of the weaknesses, I think, that exists in the system for families, and I do understand the need to sometimes say, hey, let's remove ourselves from our family that might be causing distress or and maybe making it worse. But at the same time, then they walk into a model, a medical model that's diagnosing them, that's stigmatizing them in many ways, or at least that's what I hear from consumers, the patients themselves, that then they go into a system that actually makes it worse because they feel further stigmatized as opposed to walking into an open dialogue situation where maybe they might feel, welcomed and not shamed or not.
I want to agree with David in support of what he was saying, but also add that the open dialogue, approach came about was that they basically they made in that area the 911 response is to invite everybody into that dialogue, and I totally acknowledge that there are times where that really can't happen or isn't appropriate. And that's true. It's not about forcing people into a dialogue that they don't want to be in, but it's about all the attention is on creating a space where that can happen and where people are invited and feel safe. But over the 35 or more years that they've been doing this, the culture of the community is that they know that this is what happens. They don't expect different. And so, they've experienced that works, that it's beneficial. It is the default response. To 911 is gather everybody, address their concerns, and help to alleviate the fear.
But then there's also the HIPAA laws, which I think we might want to discuss, where the individual in crisis, placed with a medical or psychiatric or therapeutic counselor of whatever type, the HIPAA laws prevent that person from sharing with family members. And so they're often, it becomes an obstacle because it is a family situation. The HIPAA laws put up a whole barrier to reuniting the family in a common understanding of the situation.
It's a real problem that we have.
Yeah. I think we really need, I've been watching this now for some time and watching especially what happens to people in hospitals. When they're hospitalized, that's where often this big separation occurs, mm-hmm. and it takes forever to get over that. And I think we need to revise those laws. I think they need to be rewritten to include family members when it's safe to do so, to have a mechanism of determining that safety. Because in some families, it's not safe. You have to acknowledge that.
Mm-hmm.
Privacy is important, but when I meet with somebody individually, I am obligated to protect, say, but yes. I will talk with them and say, how do we talk? Go talk with somebody else.
Yes.
But if we gather a group, everybody in that group is free to say what they want to say. I mean, I can't say it's somebody else's business, but if I create a group where everybody's present, they are free to speak for themselves. And the goal is to help them feel safe to do that.
Right.
Yeah.
Another issue that I'm thinking about, too, is when my son turned 21, when he developed his illness and how hard it is to put him into the hospital or to do anything with him, because if he talks to the medic or the doctor, he'll be one way, and then the next day he'll be another way, and there's no way to, as a parent, to really help somebody or do something with them once they turn 21.
Legal age.
But that's also, in a way, that's kind of good. It's like, okay, we're not treating them as an object of our, responsibility and treatment anymore. Right. We're treating them as an equal. And the task then is, again, how do we create a... It's not about forcing people into dialogues again.
Right.
But so then the job becomes, how do we make this dialogue safe? And what we have found is that when that's where you put your attention... And people become aware that there's a dialogue happening that is relevant to them, and when they're satisfied that it is safe, they always join. They cannot stay away.
Yeah.
It seems HIPAA laws and this legal majority age are double-edged swords in these situations. Mm-hmm. Yeah. They help in some ways, but they also obstruct in other ways. That it's becomes very complicated.
Because it's constructing the problem as one that exists within that one person. And this approach is one that says, we have a problem that exists among many people.
Right.
Let's figure out how to address that.
Yeah. And again, it deals with the current system deals with a stigmatizing version of the problem versus, as you're saying, a collective problem that we can all get through, a human problem.
Yeah, in the course of finding that collective distress, then we might identify something that does happen to be going on within one person that they haven't been able to express. I'm not saying that doesn't happen.
But our
focus is on the collective group.
To give listeners contact information, they can go to namisantafe.org, or also for Open Dialogue, if you'd like to explore that more, you can contact Kermit Cole at gmail.com. Also, visit our website at ksfr.org.